Welcome to Parents' Perspective. For all of us who think we know that early education began with Head Start, we've got a surprise for you.
Early education started in the early days of the Republic when parents sent their children to school as early as 2 years old to get them out from underfoot on the farm so the mothers could get their work done. Early education also emerged during the 1820s and 1830s in the United States in the form of what were called infant schools, which incidentally were an institution imported from England to the United States. This was chiefly for working mothers, and although others soon added them, for working mothers of children as young as a year and a half went to infant schools. And the question that naturally arises is, why did infant schools disappear? In part, the scholars will tell you that it was because of a gentleman named Amariah Brigham, an eminent physician who was the head of two insane asylums. He helped found the American Psychiatric Society, and he created and edited what's now the Journal of Psychiatry. In 1833, Brigham wrote an influential work arguing that developing young children's mind carried great peril to develop their minds, that in trying to, and I quote you from the work, in trying to cultivate the intellectual faculties of children before they are 6 or 7 years of age, serious and lasting injury has been done to both the body and the mind. He, in effect, was arguing that infant schools would likely lead to insanity. The argument had considerable effect. It contributed not only to the death of infant schools, but also to the shaping of the kindergarten movement and the virtual disappearance of 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds from public schools for more than a century.
And that's the subject of our talk today about our country's public schools and where they are heading. We hope not to an insane asylum.
Some argue that that's what they are.
I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We're happy to have our guest back with us, Noel Epstein, to continue our discussion about how the schools are expected to do double duty. Noel Epstein has spent more than 40 years as a journalist with The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal. He has written and edited 2 books and is currently an independent consultant. In 1969, he was also a writer and editor for the White House Conference on Children and Youth. Noel has 2 grown daughters and 4 grandchildren with another on the way. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Noel.
Thank you very much. One of the important things, I think, to remember in all of this that we're discussing is that bringing children to school at very early age is not a new phenomenon in the United States. And many working mothers ought to know. Horace Greeley, who went on to be editor of the New York Tribune and ran for president, started school at 2, and there were others, eminent people, who did. And we shouldn't be thinking that parents today, if they work, are doing something, you know, unique or terrible and not staying home with their kids. If they have to, particularly if they have to work, then, I mean, you particularly can't blame parents. In the same way, school lunch programs have been around for a long time. We've certainly had lunch. It's very interesting in each one of these cases, particularly school lunch or sex education programs, you know, that today are designed in part to fight sexually transmitted diseases and particularly HIV/AIDS. Sex education has been around for more than a century. And, of course, conservative parents opposed that when it was begun at the beginning, early days of the 20th century. Just as conservatives opposed school meals. After World War II, school lunches started by women volunteers in various schools for disadvantaged students, and they would bring in soup and sandwiches and feed the kids, which really got the vendors who sold food around the schools quite angry in those days. Then the schools took over the function. During the Great Depression, the school lunch program got federal support for two reasons. One, they employed more than 65 or nearly 65,000 women in school lunch programs. So they provided jobs and income for families who were having a hard time. And number two, they found an outlet for surplus farm products, which couldn't be sold. You know, that was a big problem, the farm economy during the Great Depression. And that started the schools as a significant market for American agriculture, which it still is today, both for the farmer and for the food processors who sell lots of school lunches. So they've been around a long time. And then we added breakfasts and snacks and dinners. But in the debate about making school lunches permanent after World War II, the conservatives complained that we were going to make children wards of the state because of providing school lunches to them. And Senator Taft, the great conservative senator from Ohio, said during the debate that if we're going to provide school lunches, we might as well start providing shoes for all children in the United States. Actually, we did start providing some shoes under the civil rights laws for certain children for a while. But in any case, every one of these things have been opposed by conservatives in some times. But I have to emphasize that these are not left-wing programs by themselves. They're programs created by the left, the right, and by business in between. You have had conservatives want to promote sexual abstinence, and therefore you have abstinence programs in the schools. Conservatives want to promote and do promote character educations to teach the golden rule and good and bad and right and wrong to children. And there's a lot of character mm-hmm. education taught in the schools. Liberals concentrate on other programs, and business does things like early childhood things because of labor concerns. So it goes across the spectrum how you end up with all these programs heaped on the schools.
We've been talking about sort of what's creeping up to be happening in the schools and a little bit about the cycle that things seem to be taking. Is there a model that you would advocate for all this?
Well, I don't think there's really a single model. I think that there's a general idea that I would advocate exploring. And in fact, one of the things I've been thinking about doing for some time is a book just on this subject. I mean, I did a chapter in a book that I edited for Brookings on this, a book called Who's in Charge Here, which is about the confusion and who runs the schools and who makes the policy.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion about schools doing double duty.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Noel Epstein about schools and their responsibilities to our children.
I am very interested in this general way in what are called community schools are doing, although I don't favor the name community schools because all schools are community schools in one way or another. They're also known as settlement houses in schools because they really do use the Jane Hull settlement house model, and they're known by other names. But these schools are places where community-based organizations and non-teachers, people who are trained to deal with drugs, teenage pregnancy, which incidentally we didn't mention, but is another responsibility of the schools, not only a responsibility, but the schools have become the principal people who we rely on to fight drugs and teenage pregnancy and other programs. But they bring in people who are authoritative in each one of these areas. They bring in social workers from the community. They bring in anti-drug programs from the community. They bring in people who are knowledgeable in psychology and psychiatry for students who are depressed, students who are suicidal. They have school health centers, which is a very interesting phenomenon in the United States. We now have in hundreds of schools health centers that are not school nurses anymore. We're talking about centers with nurse practitioners who can prescribe medications, with psychiatrists or psychologists more often, with social workers and others that are in or near the school and related to schools. This has happened in schools around the country, and it's no longer just high schools where these started. They're also in junior high schools, middle schools, and elementary schools related to them. It's a very interesting phenomenon. There's a woman named Julia Lear Graham. I believe that's her name. She's at the Center for Health and Healthcare in Schools at George Washington University's public health program, who does a lot of work in this area and pulls together stuff, which is someplace, if you go online, you can do, I believe it's schoolhealth.org, and up will come this program, this school, Center for School Health in the schools. In any case, community schools bring in the community into the schools, and some mayors have used community schools as a way to reorganize all city services for school youth and children. In other words, in Multnomah County, which includes Portland, Oregon, and surrounding counties, they now have, I believe, something like scheduled to have 100 schools that have been reorganized to bring in the services from the community into the school, the non-academic mm-hmm. services. And Washington, D.C., they also have an agreement to do something like this in the schools, to provide space in the schools for the agencies of the city. Now, I think it's very important to look at this kind of model because school educators don't know, they're not trained to be psychologists. They think they are, but they're really not trained, or to deal with drug problems, or to deal with pregnancy of teenagers and parents. You know, schools in many places now provide nurseries for children of mm-hmm. teenage students as well, another responsibility we put on the schools. So they're kind of like grandparents, too. And those of us sitting around here who are grandparents know all about that. So I really think it's important to look at that. I would like to go out and look at a lot of these community schools and other schools and see how they are working. I don't think we have really a report that's useful on how they are and aren't working. The advocacy groups like the Coalition for Community Schools will argue, of course, that there's lots of evidence, but I'd like to see it firsthand myself and go out and look at that. So that's one model for how you deal with this. Now, these community schools, incidentally, they provide all kinds of services, including services for parents like the settlement houses used to mm-hmm. in Jane Hull's days mm-hmm. in Chicago and the others in New York, so Henry Street settlements and so forth.
So in a way, they are also parenting centers to help parents maybe understand how to do their job better at home.
They are indeed, and many schools now provide programs to teach students who have children how to be parents also. So they have many parenting mm-hmm. programs in schools. And again, we used to call this the problem of wayward girls. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There were no wayward boys
That's
in
right.
the world,
only
wayward girls, mm-hmm. which is absurd. And I would like to see how these community schools work up close. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that would take a lot of time and a lot of mm-hmm. traveling. Mm-hmm. I also happen to be an advocate of schools being under the authority of mayors and governors as opposed to school boards and school superintendents.
Why is that, for accountability?
Well, first of all, we Americans don't realize, but many years ago we created a separate government for schools, for education. And we actually have two governments in the United States, one for education and one for everything else. This goes back to Massachusetts, the early days in the 1700s, where they created a separate school board. But it was really reinforced heavily and more formalized at the turn of the 20th century. We wanted to take education out of politics. You see, before then, when you had a Boss Tweed winning election in New York City, he would use the schools for patronage jobs, and he'd name campaign workers, teachers, principals, area administrators, and so forth. In those days, you had lots of school boards. You had cities with 100 school boards, you know, local school boards. And to take education out of politics, they created the modern school board and the modern school superintendent at the state and local level, which is how you have state school chiefs, who nobody knows about or who they are. And very few people really know who are the members of their school board, except when there's an issue in your child's school, then you suddenly get roused and get involved, or at least some parents do.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion about schools doing double duty.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $10 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Noel Epstein about schools and their responsibilities to our children.
I was talking to the gentleman who headed the Education Commission of the States, for whom I commissioned and wrote this book,
Who's in
Charge, which the Brookings Institution Press published. And this gentleman had been the chief state school officer, the superintendent of schools in three major states, Ohio, Illinois, and Nevada, as I recall. And I asked him how many people in those states even knew who you were. And his answer was, "Do you mean other than my wife and kids?"
Oh, my.
Because nobody knows who the state
superintendent
is. There are members of the state board of education who nobody understands, and they don't report to the governor. The governor is not in charge in almost all states. The governor is not in charge of education, even though the governor is in charge of everything else, just like the mayor is responsible for police, fire, sanitation, health and human services, and all kinds of other things. Why is he not responsible for the schools?
So the idea is you have an autonomous body, not responsible to anybody.
And very few people know about
it. And they're doing whatever they're doing. Uh-huh.
And very few people understand it. There's a great confusion in the United States about who's in charge of the schools, which is what this book is about. Mm-hmm. What's happened in recent years, by which I mean the last couple of decades at least, is that power has been taken away from local school board, more and more power, and given first to the state, which is how you got state standards in math, science, and so forth. And the states realized they weren't accomplishing a lot, and they needed, quite frankly, they wouldn't say that, but education in terms of student achievement didn't improve a lot. Remember Goals 2000?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Goals 2000 came and went, and none of the goals were even remotely reached. And the federal government got involved at that level with Goals 2000. They had the meeting with the first President Bush and the governors, and they created these goals, which they failed to ever reach, even close. And then No Child Left Behind came in and created a bigger federal role, which the states are now complaining about. Of course, the locals complained about the states interfering in what they were doing. Now the states, as well as the locals, are complaining about the federal government. There's great confusion about who's in charge of the schools. My feeling is that this is the most fundamental problem facing the schools across all issues, both academic and all these non-academic programs we've been talking about, that nobody's accountable, nobody's in charge, and nobody takes the blame. They only take the credit when things go well. In other words, if the schools do very, very poorly in the next 4 years, nobody's going to say it was George Bush's fault, even though he's been driving a lot of the policies that the schools have been forced to adopt and his administration. And the states for a long time were driving policies, two decades at least. Well, actually, it started in the late 60s. It was Southern governors who started all this because the South was falling behind economically and they wanted to attract industry and jobs to their states. So they started reforming their school systems, and that's how you got the start of school reforms in the United States in modern times. And now there's great confusion. My own personal preference is for mayors and governors to be in charge, principally, because you know who they are. They are visible. You can hold them accountable. It is often the largest item in their budgets at the local and state level, education. And if you don't like it, you can kick them out of office. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that every mayor and governor is going to do smart things on education. But when you start kicking them out of office, they're going to start doing smarter things on education. Mm-hmm. So that's my view on all this.
Well, this is a clarion call for everybody listening out there.
Another
thing to pay attention to. Well, we unfortunately have to close, and this is a conversation that could go on for a very long time. There's an awful lot to talk about. But what resources would you suggest for our listeners who would like to pursue this topic further?
Well, there are lots of different resources for different listeners. I mentioned the Center for Health and Healthcare in the Schools that Julia Graham Lear runs. It's www.healthandschools.org. You get a lot of information on health and social issues in the schools there. It's a really fascinating website. I recommend it. Then there's the Coalition for Community Schools that's headed by a gentleman named Marty Blank, which is communityschools.org. That's one word, www.communityschools.org. There's always, as I'm sure everybody knows out there, the Children's Defense Fund, which touches on a lot of these issues.
No Child Left Behind.
There's the National Child Care Information Center, if you're interested in lots of child care issues. It's www.nccic, for Child Care, National Child Care Information Center.org, NCCIC. There's a site called Just for Kids, which has a lot of kids' issues on it, called Just and the Number 4 Kids.org. For what's happening in different states, you can go to ecs.org. That's the Education Commission of the states. They have a wealth of information on their websites on policies out there in the states. For books, there's a lady named Joy Dryfoos, Dryfoos, who has written a lot of works on community schools and advocated them. It's useful to get a hold of her works. One is called Inside Full Service Community Schools, if you're interested in seeing how some schools have been reformed to deal with all these non-academic health and social issues that we heap on the schools. There's a wonderful book called The Price of Motherhood, which might be of interest to your listeners in general, by Anne Crittenden, The Price of Motherhood. The subtitle, which I'm sure many of your listeners will agree with, is Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. So there are those resources. There are others. If you want to read about school governance and the confusion out there, the book that I edited for the Education Commission of the States and published by the Brookings Institution Press is called Who's in Charge Here? The Tangled Web of School Governance and Policy. And has my name on it, Noel Epstein, as the editor.
Well, Noel Epstein, this has been such a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much for demystifying some of the issues about our public schools.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 286. That's 1-800-791-8573. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a very big help to us. Also, if you can, tell us what station you're listening to. Since we air all over the world, it's always fun to know where you are tuning in. Our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, is available in all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. At the site, you can click on to listen to podcasts to hear a show anytime. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share parents' perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Joseph and Anna Smith Foundation. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.